readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, is feeling the pain of September's frantic pace. Summer's over. It just is. There's school, there's kid homework, there's your work. There's no hope of time off for months and months. Grim. Just grim. But wait. This edition of the Book Report brings comic relief. It's a lighthearted look at books that bring you the absurd side of things. I've got a fabulously funny interview for you, surrounded by audio titles for everyone's sense of humor. The South, the neurotic New Yorkers, the Gen Xers, and the classics. Get ready to smile as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Joan Rivers is a groundbreaking, internationally renowned entertainment goddess. She's also just a tad opinionated, especially when it comes to people she hates, like those ladies who think giving birth is a unique achievement, or those well-adjusted, aka boring, ex-child stars who don't even have a decent addiction. With all of her experiences, Joan has seen, done, said, and heard a lot of hateful things. Thank goodness she took notes. Here, uncensored and totally uninhibited, Joan performs I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me. She disses first ladies, closet cases, hypocrites, Hollywood, feminists, and overrated historical figures. And even when she's letting herself have it, Joan doesn't hold back. In this honest, hilarious love letter to the hater in all of us.
Love may be a many splendid thing, but hate makes the world go round. If you think I am kidding, just watch the 6 o'clock news. The first 29 minutes are all about dictators and murderers and terrorists and maniacs and, worst of all, real housewives. And then, at the very, very end of the show, there's a 30-second human interest story about some schmuck who married his cat. I rest my case. Some things I've hated forever. Some things are new acquisitions, and some are just passing fancies. Today I hate happy TV weathermen, feminists who believe Gloria Steinem's great looks hurt her, Gloria Steinem herself, people who mispronounce the word ask, axe, we know those guys, studio apartments, guidance counselors, first ladies, old people. Anyhow, if any of this offends you, or if you happen to love puppies and kittens and the infirm, well, I'm impressed. I hate you, but I am impressed. I know what you're thinking. Joan, hate is a very strong word. You're right, it is. But I use it as an umbrella term, the way mental health professionals use the word schizophrenia, as a catch-all for any particular brand of crazy they can't identify. So when I say hate, I don't necessarily mean hate. I could also mean loathe, detest, abhor, dislike, despise, resent. See, isn't that kinder and gentler? If you think this makes you a better person than I am, good. You're the idiot that actually paid for this book. I didn't. For those of you thinking, geez, Joan seems a little angry, you're half right. I am angry. I'm fed up. I am fed up with the morons and the losers and the cretins who are cluttering up the planet. Emma Lazarus wrote, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." Fine, but not on my block. Being fed up and angry, let me tell you, is better than being depressed. Psychologists keep telling us that depression is just anger turned inwards. And you know what I say? Then why waste your time? It is what it is. And quite frankly, I'd rather be angry than depressed. Why? Because antidepressants like Prozac and Wellbutrin and Zoloft can cause bloating. Bloating. And I hate bloating. I need to go back, you know, and add bloating to the list of things that I hate. I mean, come on. Is there anything worse than not being able to fit into a size 2 Valentino? I think not. Talk about depressing. I am so tired of people saying to me, "Joan, could you please try to be nice to Harry? He's depressed." No. Why the hell should I have to work like a pack animal trying to be nice to Harry because that is having a bad day? Depression is a buzzkill for everyone involved, except, of course, for the person who's actually depressed. That moody sourpuss gets all the attention, which only feeds their narcissism. I believe the great philosopher Descartes said it best when he said, "I whine, therefore I am." He was Jewish. But who really cares about what Descartes said? You know where Descartes is today? Dead. Dead. So much for honesty being the best policy. Before I move on, can I just say, I hate the French. Note to self, please put this right away on the list. And why? Because those morons still think Jerry Lewis is fabulous. That's why. For the very few of you who are still listening to this, I'll tell you what else I hate. I hate it when people say, "Oh, let's invite Jane to the party. She's going through a difficult time." You know what I say? I say, "Jane, I am paying top dollar for a caterer. You know something? Let Jane slash her wrists in her house." Introverted, depressed people just suck the life out of a good party. Angry, hateful people, they liven things up. You give me just one person who is still angry the Third Reich was toppled, and I swear to you, I'll give you a great dinner party. Did you ever walk into an amazing party and you're strolling around and you're going from room to room and you're making small talk and slipping those nice serving spoons into your purse, and then all of a sudden you run into a sweaty, angry guy in the library who looks like the Unabomber with better fashion sense? You know, I mean, the kind of guy who tells you that he doesn't care if the glass is half full or half empty, he only hopes it's broken, and that Kenny G drinks from it and cuts his lips off and ruins his career.
That was I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me, by Joan Rivers. To quote my friend Dave Barry, Gina Baraka is very, very funny for a woman. Gina is most recently the author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquer the World. Gina has appeared on 2020, 48 Hours, NPR, the BBC, The Today Show, and Oprah to discuss gender, power, politics, and humor. She's the editor of 17 books, including the Signet Book of American Humor and the Penguin Book of Women's Humor. Gina writes for the Brainstorm section of the Chronicle of Higher Education and blogs for Psychology Today. She does a weekly column for the Hartford Courant, a monthly column for Principal Leadership, and occasionally spars with Gene Weingarten in his Below the Beltway column in the Washington Post. With degrees from Dartmouth College, Cambridge University, and the City University of New York, Baraka is professor of English and feminist theory at the University of Connecticut. Welcome, Gina. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
I am absolutely delighted to be here.
We share a common friend, Dave Barry.
I think that one of the nicest things you can have in common with somebody is Dave Barry. That's a really good start.
So Dave was in London at the Olympics, and I sent him an email, and I said, "What should I ask Gina?" And he said, "Ask Gina how she really feels about Gene Weingarten." So?
All right. Gene Weingarten is so much more of a sweetheart than anybody gives him credit for being. Now, he and I met. We did this book together called I'm With Stupid. One Man, One Woman, and 10,000 Years of Misunderstanding Between the Sexes Cleared Right Up, which is one of the world's longest titles, but that's fine with me. And Weingarten and I did the book together because he phoned me one day at my office. Now, my day job is I'm a college professor. I teach English and feminist theory at the University of Connecticut. I've been doing that for 25 years. So I'm there. I'm real. I'm tenured. I made full professor before menopause. You know, it's the feminist dream. So I'm sitting at my desk. I have two research assistants in my, you know, I'm on the ground floor, basically in the basement. You know, some things come with perks, some things don't. And I get this phone call from someone who identifies himself as from the Washington Post. I'm like, okay. And he says, I'd like to, very, you know, nasal voice, I'd like to interview you because I hear you're an expert on feminism and humor. And I said, yes, I'd just done a book on that. And my first book had been called, they used to call me Snow White, but I drifted. And that had done very well and got into many printings. And this was another book I'd recently written before that. And so Weingarten said, being an expert on feminism and humor is like being an expert on oysters and accordions. They don't go together. And I said, gee, I've just spent the last 15 years of my life making sure that that's not in fact the case. So you want to talk about this? You want to take it outside? What do you want to do, mister, who I don't even know, who's calling me at my office? And so as he then said, he thought it would just be a way to torment a girl academic. I'm from Brooklyn. And it turns out that Gene sort of met his match. We, over the space of a year, did a series of columns that appeared in the Washington Post as Gene's humor columns. They're known as the Gene and Gina columns. And we started out competing about who's funnier, men or women. And we let his readers vote. And I won. And then Weingarten said, well, that must be a mistake. So we did it again, and I won a second time. And then Weingarten, being no fool, said, let's get a book contract. And so he went out and did precisely that. And then the final version was I'm With Stupid. He thinks that women are funny, which I think a lot of men, don't tell anybody, but a lot of men don't.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I think didn't Dave Barry say that you were very, very funny for a woman?
And I put that on the front cover of my book. Yes, a very, very funny dot for a woman dot. Yes, and I still consider that a great compliment. And that was for my most recent collection, which is called It's Not That I'm Bitter, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquer the World. Part of why it's called It's Not That I'm Bitter was that after Weingarten and I did I'm With Stupid, Gene then went on to win two Pulitzer Prizes. I didn't. So it's not that I'm bitter. What else was I going to call the next book? Of course, that's what I was going to call the next book. He won his two Pulitzer Prizes, of course, for very different projects. But I really do enjoy the kind of writing that I do and why I'm here at the Writers' Conference today. Because writing humor allows you to address topics that are otherwise taboo, otherwise would be considered off limits, or that people simply wouldn't pay attention to. I get to write about feminism, the last F word in our culture. People won't say feminism. They'll say everything else that starts with an F, but they won't say feminist. And they will, the belief that somehow women have no sense of humor does come up about every 10 years. It's as if we need to somehow get out there and make a plea for this, where it seems sort of remarkable. And I love being able to write columns. They're now distributed by the McClatchy Tribune Syndicate on things that you would not think would necessarily be of interest to people around the world. But I wrote one on how, you know, from 18 to 21, a woman's body is a temple, and how from 21 to 35, it's an amusement park, and how from 40 onward, it's a terrarium. Because every woman I know is like, we're all taking these probiotic things that have 50 billion kinds of flora to keep your intestinal tracts. I thought, I've suddenly become House and Gardens, you know, in my, I've never actually weeded, but I'm suddenly becoming this floracopia. And it turns out that everybody feels the same way about everything. And as long as you tell it with, you know, Dickinson said, tell the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. And I think that comedy is one of the more interesting circuits that way. You sort of go around the topic a little bit, but you get back into the heart of it.
Can humor writers be nurtured, or must they be born that way?
Oh, I think the nurturing part is essential, because humor really does depend on an audience. It's sort of like, just like you can't dance in your room by yourself and say you're a ballerina, you can't actually say you're a humorist if no one ever hears you say anything or reads your work. You can't be a humorist and have everything just sit in the drawer. Maybe more than any other kind of writing, it needs that that interlocutor. It needs that other person to respond. You only fully write humor if somebody else thinks it's funny. And that's really hard to... one of the reasons it's hard to write humor is because you really have to imagine your audience in your head, and your audience isn't always going to have the same sense of humor that you do. So one of the things that is interesting in learning how to workshop humor pieces is for people to understand the idea of an audience that they're going to need to bring to the humor, that the humor is not going to go get there all by itself, that the author, the writer of humor, is going to need to give it some apparatus and some kind of help and architecture to make that happen.
So would it help a humor writer to actually try and do some, if you will, stand-up?
What they need to do is to do, I don't think that they actually have to do that, but they need to pay attention to the sorts of things that stand-ups pay attention to naturally, which is, for example, a sense of timing on the page. Just as stand-ups need to leave room for somebody to laugh, you need to give time for people to react. Stand-ups know that you can't trample all over your own funny lines. You have to give a little bit of space for somebody to get it. The same thing needs to happen in humor writing. It's not just a series of jokes. It's a series of well-timed stories. So there has to be a build-up. There has to be kind of a repetition. You have to involve the audience in a way that they're allowed to be in on the joke and creators of the joke.
How is it that humor writers are able to step back from absurdities of life that make most of us upset, but see situations in a humorous way?
Well, there's the old adage that says pain plus time equals humor. And pretty much everything plus time equals humor. And one of the most important things, I think, is for folks to understand that humor is transformative, that almost anything with a different perspective on it can be made into a funny story. Not to dismiss it, but just to be able to sort of own it, to be able to understand it differently, to take an entirely new vision of a very old problem.
So are you working on another book right now?
Yes, actually, I'm working on one about women's friendships, because I think that that's a really underplayed, important series of relationships. And I also think that everything that's written about it is very warm and fuzzy and sentimental. And I want to get to the mean, vicious, interesting, fabulous edge that women's friendships really have to them. So I'm playing with those ideas, and I'm having a very good time.
And when might we see that book?
It's in the beginning stages now, so figure probably about a year and a half. I think that that's what got lots of titles floating around, none I've decided on yet, so I'm always looking for good ideas. People should email me at GinaBarecca.com. I answer all my emails, and lots of essays are up there for people to take a look at, and so I'll give away a book to the best title for the next book on women's friendships that I can find.
All right, spell your name and website.
Okay, it's Gina, G-I-N-A BARRECA.com. GinaBarecca.com, all one word.
Okay, we got a contest going.
All right, sounds good to me. Thanks so much.
Thanks for stopping by.
Bernadette Fox is notorious. To her Microsoft guru husband, she's a fearlessly opinionated partner. To fellow private school moms in Seattle, she's a disgrace. To design mavens, she's a revolutionary architect. And to 15-year-old B, she is simply mom. Then Bernadette disappears. The tale of Maria Semple's Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Begins when B aces her report card and claims her promised reward, a family trip to Antarctica. But Bernadette's intensifying allergy to Seattle and people in general has made her so agoraphobic that a virtual assistant in India now runs all of her basic errands. A trip to the end of the earth could be very problematic. To find her mother, Bea compiles email messages, official documents, secret correspondence, and creates a humorous, touching novel about misplaced genius and a mother and daughter's role in an absurd world. Kathleen Wilhoit narrates.
She got up and started stuffing empty takeout containers into the bags they'd been delivered in. Dad was already deep into the brochure. "It's their summer," he said. "It's the only time you can go." "Because ponies are cute." Mom tied the handles in a knot. "What do you say?" Dad looked up at Mom. "Isn't this a bad time for you because of work?" she asked him. "We're studying Antarctica," I said. "I've read all the explorers' journals, and I'm doing my presentation on Shackleton." I started wiggling in my chair. "I can't believe it. Neither of you are saying no." "I was waiting for you," Dad said to Mom. "You hate to travel." "I was waiting for you," Mom said back. "You have to work." "Oh, my God, that's a yes!" I jumped out of my chair. "That's a yes!" My joy was so infectious that Ice Cream woke up and started barking and doing victory laps around the kitchen table.
"Is that a yes?" Dad asked Mom over the crackling of plastic takeout containers being crammed into the trash. "That's a yes," she said.
Tuesday, November 16th. From Bernadette Box to Manjula Kapoor. Manjula, something unexpected has come up, and I'd love it if you could work extra hours. From my end, this trial period has been a lifesaver. I hope it's working for you, too. If so, please let me know ASAP, because I need you to work your Hindu magic on a huge project. Okay, I'll stop being coy. You know I have a daughter, B. She's the one you order the medicine for and wage valiant battle with the insurance company over. Apparently, my husband and I told her she could have anything she wanted if she graduated middle school with straight A's. The straight A's have arrived. Or should I say straight S's? Because Gaylor Street's one of those liberal grades erode self-esteem type schools. Let's hope you don't have them in India. And so what does B want? To take a family trip to Antarctica. Of the million reasons I don't want to go to Antarctica, the main one is that it will require me to leave the house. You might have figured by now that's something I don't much like to do. But I can't argue with Bea. She's a good kid. She has more character than LG and I and the next 10 guys combined. Plus, she's applying to boarding school for next fall, which of course she'll get into because of said A's. Whoops. S's. So it would be in pretty bad taste to deny Buzzy this. The only way to get to Antarctica is by cruise ship. Even the smallest one has 150 passengers, which translates into me being trapped with 149 other people who will uniquely annoy the hell out of me with their rudeness, waste, idiotic questions, incessant yammering, creepy food requests, boring small talk, etc. Or worse, they might turn their curiosity toward me and expect pleasantry in return. I'm getting a panic attack just thinking about it. A little social anxiety never hurt anyone, am I right? If I give you the info, could you pretty please take over the paperwork, visas, plane tickets, everything involved with getting we three from Seattle to the White Continent? Is this something you have time for? Say yes, Bernadette. Oh, you already have credit card numbers to pay for airfare, trip, and accoutrements. But in terms of your salary, I'd like you to take it directly out of my personal account. When LG saw the visa charge for your work last month, even though it wasn't much money, he wasn't thrilled that I'd hired a virtual assistant from India. I told him I wouldn't be using you anymore. So if we could, Manjula, let's keep our romance an illicit one. From Manjula Kapoor. To Bernadette Fox. Dear Ms. Fox, it would be my pleasure to assist you with your family travel plans to Antarctica. Attached, please find the contract for moving forward on a full-time basis. Where indicated, please include your bank routing number. I look forward to our continued collaboration. Warm regards, Manjula.
We've just heard Where'd You Go, Bernadette? By Maria Semple.
Rachel Joyce's debut novel, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, is making such a stir and climbing the Times bestseller list, the Book Report just had to bring it to you. Harold lives in a small English village with his wife Maureen, who is irritated by almost every little thing he does. Life drones on, with little to differentiate one day from the next. Then, one morning, the mail arrives with a letter addressed to Harold from a woman he hasn't seen or heard from in 20 years. Queenie Hennessy is in hospice and is writing to say goodbye. Harold pens a quick reply and heads to the mailbox. But then he has a chance encounter, one that convinces him he absolutely must deliver his message to Queenie in person. And thus begins the unlikely pilgrimage. Harold Fry is determined to walk 600 miles from Kingsbridge to Queenie in hospice because he believes as long as he walks, Queenie will live. Still in his yachting shoes and light coat, Harold embarks on his urgent quest. Along the way, he meets one fascinating character after another, each of whom unlocks his long-dormant spirit and sense of promise. Jim Broadbent brings his fabulous acting skills to this novel of charm, insight, and humor.
Harold passed her what she needed and returned to his letter. Beautifully set out, of course. Nothing like the muddled writing on the envelope. Then he smiled, remembering this was how it always was with Queenie. Everything she did so precise you couldn't fault it. When she remembers you, she sends her regards. Maureen's mouth pinched into a bead.
A chap on the radio was saying the French want our bread. They can't get it sliced in France. They come over here and they buy it all up. The chap said there might be a shortage by summer.
She paused.
Harold? Is something the matter?
He said nothing. He drew himself up tall, with his lips parted, his face bleached. His voice, when at last it came, was small and far away. It's cancer. Queenie is writing to say goodbye. He fumbled for more words, but there weren't any. Tugging a handkerchief from his trouser pocket, Harold blew his nose. Gosh! Tears crammed his eyes. Moments passed. Maybe minutes. Maureen gave a swallow that smacked the silence. I'm sorry, she said. He nodded. He ought to look up, but he couldn't.
It's a nice morning, she began again. Why don't you fetch out the patio chairs?
But he sat, not moving, not speaking, until she lifted the dirty plates. Moments later, the vacuum cleaner took up from the hall. Harold felt winded. If he moved so much as a limb, even a muscle, he was afraid it would trigger an abundance of feeling he was doing his best to contain. Why had he let 20 years pass without trying to find Queenie Hennessy? A picture came of the small, dark-haired woman with whom he had worked all that time ago. And it seemed inconceivable that she was, what, 60? And dying of cancer in Berwick? Of all the places, he thought, he had never travelled so far north. He glanced out at the garden and saw a ribbon of plastic caught in the laurel bush, flapping up and down but never pulling free. He tucked Queenie's letter into his pocket, patted it twice for safekeeping, and rose to his feet. Upstairs, Maureen shut the door of David's room quietly and stood a moment, breathing him in. She pulled open his blue curtains that she closed every night and checked there was no dust where the hem of the net drapes met the windowsill. She polished the silver frame of his Cambridge portrait and the black and white baby photograph beside it. She kept the room clean because she was waiting for David to come back, and she never knew when that would be. A part of her was always waiting. Men had no idea what it was like to be a mother. The ache of loving a child, even when he had moved on. She thought of Harold downstairs with his pink letter, and wished she could talk to their son. Maureen left the room as softly as she had entered it, and went to strip the beds. Harold Fry took several sheets of Basildon Bond from the dresser drawer and one of Maureen's rollerball pens. "What did you say to a dying woman with cancer?" He wanted her to know how sorry he felt, but it was wrong to put in sympathy, because that was what the cards in the shop said after, as it were, the event. And anyway, it sounded formal, as if he didn't really care. He tried, "Dear Miss Hennessy, I sincerely hope your condition improves." But when he put down the pen to inspect his message, it seemed both stiff and unlikely. He crumpled the paper into a ball and tried again. He had never been good at expressing himself. What he felt was so big it was difficult to find the words, and even if he could, it was hardly appropriate to write them to someone he had not contacted in 20 years. Had the shoe been on the other foot, Queenie would have known what to do.
We've just heard The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. What do we believe? And in God's name, why? Lewis Black has the answers, or at least his answers. Black survived Hebrew school and a bar mitzvah, was a college kid in the 60s who saw parallels between religious rapture and drug-induced visions, explored the self-actualization of the 70s, and turned a cynical eye toward politicians who donned the cloak of religious rectitude to cover up their own hypocrisy. What he learned about the inconsistencies and peculiarities of religion infuriates him, and in his Me of Little Faith, Black explores how the rules and constraints of religion have affected all of our lives. Hilarious experiences with rabbis, Mormons, gurus, psychics, and even the joy of a perfect round of golf give Black, who performs the book, the chance to expound as only he can, upon what we believe and why.
I wish I could tell you that God had appeared to me and commanded that I reveal unto the peoples of the earth all of his mysteries, and that I was the Antichrist. Now that's a cash cow waiting to happen. But the Antichrist wouldn't write a book. He'd have a reality show and all sorts of digital downloads, and he'd leave mind-altering messages on cell phones. Yet I noticed as I began to write that there has lately been a glut of books about religion. Atheists and true believers, critics of all stripes and defenders of the faith, they have destroyed hundreds of thousands of trees with their knowledge, research, opinions, and beliefs. This is so typical of my life. I decide to write a book on religion, and as soon as I sign the contract, the shelves overflow with new books on the subject from every imaginable point of view. And so, yet again, is my belief in God undermined. What? I could see if I wrote a book on Iraq. We can't seem to get enough of those. It's like Chinese food. You can read all you want on the subject, but within minutes of finishing a book, you are hungry for more. I guess the flood of these theology books makes sense. With the excesses of violence committed in the name of God wherever you look, and the obscene power of religion and politics in our homes and in our lives. Or maybe it's just the growing sense that the world might end at any moment, which seems to hang in the air around us like a late afternoon thundershower. I guess this has sent the keyboards a-twittering. Then, of course, there's the constant flow of books in which authors talk about their conversions. So what am I, Lewis Black, stand-up comic and Me of Little Faith, doing putting my 2 cents in about religion? Because I think it's taken too seriously. And anything that takes itself too seriously is open to ridicule. What am I thinking? When you write about people's beliefs, you're asking for it. Every page here has the potential to offend someone somewhere in perpetuity throughout the universe. That doesn't even count the critics who will say it wasn't funny enough, or serious enough, or spiritual enough. Religion? Funny? You gotta be kidding. I am kidding, but it's not gonna be seen that way by everyone, which is exactly why you've gotta keep poking fun at it. After millennia of religion being used as a club, either to scare the shit out of children or to send them to war, someone's got to search for organized religion's funny bone. To put it as simply as I can, this is a book about my relationship with religion, where my, dare I say it, spiritual journey has taken me. From the religious dead ends I have wandered down to the pinpricks of light I have seen and barely understood. It's all here, in all its complicated and infuriating glory. And all of this is just my opinion, the way I look at religion, what it's meant and not meant to me, and why it makes me laugh. So if religion has taken over your life and you don't want to think about it or laugh about it because it will upset you, don't listen to this. Ever. And ever. Amen. In the beginning. As I slowly reached consciousness, everything was a mystery waiting to be solved. Unfortunately for me, I wasn't much of a problem solver. Who was this giant shoving a bottle in my mouth? Who was this other giant who wasn't around all the time, but when he did show up, would poke me? What were all these shapes and forms and sights and sounds? What the f*** was going on? Even as a kid, a sense of unease pervaded my being. As I learned to differentiate between these gentle and somewhat nurturing giants, and to say Mama and Papa, much to the giant's amusement, and as the routine of my daily life took shape and began to give me a simple understanding of what was around me, I also felt as if I was floating in a wet tissue that might tear at any moment. These are the vague flashes of my toddler years from an ever-dimming memory. I don't know if I'm imagining this or not. It's the way I remember it. Maybe my brain likes the sound of it. However, I distinctly remember reading the inspiring story, The Little Engine That Could. It says as much as any self-help book ever written. There was no God there to comfort my fears, and that has always bothered me.
We've just heard Me of Little Faith by Lewis Black. More Information Than You Require is a further compendium of complete world knowledge, assembled and illuminated by John Hodgman, a famous minor television personality. It contains hilarious half-truths, fake trivia, and amazing made-up facts. It's narrated almost entirely by resident expert John Hodgman, occasionally interrupted by a veritable extravaganza of illustrious and sometimes presumptuous guests, including Dick Cavett, Ricky Gervais, Rachel Maddow, Paul Rudd, and more.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Mimi, okay.
What do you do when you've written a great book that betters the world where you live? Do you retire and rest on your laurels? Do you continue to give? This previous book of complete world knowledge was too short and easy to read. You wrote a new book of complete world knowledge that's way more than what you need.
Good evening. My name is John Hodgman. As Jonathan Colton just mentioned in song, some years ago I wrote a volume entitled The Areas of My Expertise, which billed itself as an almanac of complete world knowledge. Now, some of you were skeptical. How could a single book of 236 pages, or if you were lucky, the audiobook of 937 CDs, contain all of complete world knowledge? Well, the answer is simple. I was lying. There is, of course, more world knowledge out there, and as it has been generated, I have learned it. And when I did not have time to learn it, I made it up. As well, my own life has gone through a remarkable transformation. Where once I was a mere professional writer and former professional literary agent, now through unexplained circumstance and strange fate, I have become a very famous minor television personality. And so I return to you now with more information than you require. A second book of complete world knowledge, now extra complete, on subjects as diverse as the past, as there is always more of it, the future, as there is still some left, all of the presidents of the United States, the secrets of Hollywood, California, gambling, the sport of the asthmatic man, Strange Encounters with Alien Life, How to Buy a Computer, How to Cook an Owl, and most other subjects. But as my life has changed, and as I come to you now with a new audiobook, so too I need a new theme song. And once again I turn to my friend Jonathan Colton, who now will tell you in song everything you need to know about me.
He sells computers and funny commercials in which he plays the PC. He wore a fat suit, he sneezed and fell down once, got nervous about surgery. Even though he's become hugely famous and wealthy, he's counting on you. If your computers are old and clunky, you know what you need to do. And tonight, you're holding a key that fits in a lock, that opens the door, that shows you a room that has a TV, that's running an ad, that's making you want some new computers. He sells computers. Please buy his computers.
That's Jonathan Colton, my feral mountain man companion.
Actually, not feral.
And he was singing my new theme song. Hey, thank you, Jonathan. That theme
song. Oh, you're welcome.
Sounded really good.
Thanks.
I just want to point something out. I don't sell computers. At all. You may be thinking about the ads, the Apple ads.
Yeah, that yeah.
I'm obviously very proud to do those, but I don't sell computers. I actually do other things too.
I hadn't noticed.
I appear on The Daily Show from time to time, and I write books.
Hmm.
Obviously, the areas of my expertise and have more information than you require.
Hmm. I guess I just knew you from the computers mostly.
We went to college together. Went to Yale together.
Really?
Yeah.
At the same time?
Yeah.
What a weird coincidence. What are the chances that we would both be at the
same time? Not a coincidence. It's actually that's how we met. That's how we first met in college.
Yeah, no.
And you don't remember that?
No, not really.
Well, we're actually recording the audiobook right now for more information than you require. That's why we're...
Oh, really?
That's why we have these microphones and these lights.
I was under the impression that we were doing one of those ads.
No. No.
For the computers.
No, this is the audiobook for my...
Okay.
But, well, what's the matter?
It's all right. I'm a little disappointed. I thought we were doing the ads and it's just the audiobook. That's all right. Can I at least get a free computer?
Well, no, you can't. I mean, no, I don't just...
I know you have it.
Okay, fine.
Just a laptop.
Here. And
thank you.
You want an iPhone too?
If you got one, yeah.
Obviously, here. But that's the ninth one I've given you, okay? That's it.
All right, I'll take care of this one.
That was More Information Than You Require by John Hodgman. Jen Lancaster, the New York Times bestselling author, gives herself and her generation a kick in the X by facing her greatest challenge to date, acting her age. The book report applauds her efforts and offers you this sampling of a very funny title. Jen, who narrates, is finally ready to put away childish things and embrace the investment-making, mortgage-carrying, life insurance-having adult she's become in her new book, Generation, that's with a J, X, one reluctant adult's attempt to unarrest her arrested development. From getting a mammogram to volunteering at a halfway house, Jen tackles grown-up activities she's resisted for years. With each rite of passage she completes, she uncovers a valuable and probably humiliating life lesson that will ease her path to full-fledged, if reluctant, adulthood.
When Douglas Copeland wrote Generation X, he was writing about me. I mean, figuratively, not literally. I read Generation X in my second senior year of college, second of six, in the time in which I briefly traded my loafers for Birkenstocks, khakis for flannel, and Wham for Nirvana. As a poster child for all things considered slacker, I clearly recall nodding my head and saying, "Yeah, man, you get it." Until I stumbled across Bridget Jones's diary 6 years later, I'd never identified more with a novel. Copeland gave voice to the ennui that every 20-something felt at the time, back in the day when we were long on promise and short on opportunity. He understood us because he was one of us, trapped between the perpetual collective optimism of those he labeled global teens, later characterized as Generation Y or the Millennials, and their baby boomer parents. Our generation defined ourselves by nothing. Technically, that's not true. Our generation defined ourselves by our perpetual fear of a Soviet invasion, playing Cold War mixtapes on our Walkman. Oh, Sting, we'd lament. We also hope the Russians love their children, too. If iPods were around back then, we'd have had entire thermonuclear war playlists filled with songs like 99 Luftballoons, Wind of Change, and Toy Soldier. Before John Hughes made them household names, we had Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy in War Games trying to persuade a Soviet supercomputer via dial-up modem that the only way to win a nuclear war is not to play. We had Red Dawn and a pre-Dirty Dancing Jennifer Grey carrying not a watermelon, but an AK-47. We had Wolverines. Then, just like that, the Cold War ended and we lost the one thing that made our generation unique. Those of us born between 1965 and 1980 had none of the benefits of the generations that came before or after us. We know nothing of the kinder, simpler America from the Camelot days, nor were we born with an innate understanding of how to operate Microsoft Windows. Today, we're a beeper generation in a smartphone world. Complicating matters is that neither the generation that came before us nor the one that's come after has demonstrated any real desire to act like adults themselves. Financial planning advertisements show baby boomers running away from corporate life to pursue dreams that, in this economy, are downright ridiculous. This is not, in fact, the time to quit your job with your 401k and health insurance to go build custom boats. I know Dennis Hopper told everyone it was okay, but he's dead now. On top of that, we've got folks in their late 20s to early 30s so wrapped up in quasi-political Facebook friend requests and Spotify and Farmville that Soviet troops could actually roll down Main Street and they'd never even notice or care. Of course, this doesn't pertain to every member of Generation Y, or Baby Boomer for that matter, or you, no matter what your generation, as you've shown remarkably good sense in having picked up this book. But it's not that far-fetched either. Hey, counselor, can you stop streaming Gilmore Girls on Netflix long enough to present your case to the jury? Okay, thanks, bye. Watching this generation operate makes me very glad that people my age understand that tools like technology and social media are a means to an end and not the end itself. My generation didn't play soccer, so we know that when the game is over, not everyone gets a trophy. Yet here we are, trapped in middle management between two massive cases of generational arrested development. And what we've determined from watching everyone else is that deciding to grow up has been our ultimate act of rebellion. So that's what those of us in Generation X have done to define ourselves. We've become the only adults in a world full of children. I mean, if I could finally grow up, anyone can.
We've just heard Generation X by Jen Lancaster. The Sweet Potato Queens are back and bodier than ever. Southern Belle extraordinaire Jill Connor Brown presents the 9th edition of the hysterical series with Fat is the New 30. Having experienced nearly all of the challenging parts of life, Brown feels it's her duty to render whatever assistance she can to her fellow sufferers. And she does so in her trademark hilarious fashion. Y'all ready for some laughs? The author narrates.
Mama's approach to any and everything was simply to declare victory, no matter what the outcome. Whatever happened was just the way she planned it by the time it was over. It was like saying you're going to Texas, telling everybody far and wide of your travel plans for the Lone Star State and shopping for Texas clothes, maybe even a new pair of cowboy boots and a hat to wear in Texas because that's where you're going. Only you somehow end up in Vermont. Just the way you planned it. And she would never waver on this stance. It's an advanced version of that's my story and I'm sticking to it, which has always been a personal favorite of mine. So for Judy to come up with fat is the new 30 is hardly even an exercise for us. We are seasoned pros at denial. We must admit, though, that we do feel that somewhat of a gauntlet has been flung down before us whenever we peruse the latest installment of People of Walmart. Surely you've seen those photos online. I cannot imagine that there is anybody alive on planet Earth today who has not seen this truly stunning and ever-growing collection of photographs. But if not, well then, pause now and go look. I warn you, it is a serious time drain, nearly impossible to tear yourself away once you begin. And I can't say that you will be a better person for having done it either. I am particularly taken by the fact that they have it broken down state by state, and I admit I have done a few comparison studies pitting our own homegrown Mississippi Walmart train wrecks to those of other, presumably more cosmopolitan locales, and the results are at once shocking and predictable. I used to wonder where that artiste with the raw meat dress came up with her costuming ideas. Well, mystery solved. One must allow that her physique is sadly not replicated in the ranks of Walmart shoppers, but her outfits certainly are. She would totally blend. Nobody would even notice her in there. It's kind of like there is one big giant family of hideous people with relatives in all 50 states, and they have at least two things in common, the only two things we can stand to consider, really. They will go to the store wearing anything, and the store they are going to is Walmart. Oh, and their last name is Gaga. I wonder if they all sing and dance. Wouldn't that be festive? At your very own local Walmart, you can see every size and shape of butts and boobs, quite often in their entirety. And you will, no doubt, note with alarm the increasing occurrence of the reversal of these two distinctive physical characteristics. Where once we expected to see, might even say we relied on it, the butts on the back side of the person and the boobs on the front, now, more and more, thanks to the ever more revealing outfits worn by unbelievably unfit Walmart shoppers all over the United States, we are subjected to the sight of back boobs and belly butts in various stages of undress and display. Based on their cornea-searing guises, we are assuming that these Walmartians are denial devotees, out practicing their craft. Either that, or they are all the visually impaired victims of an enormous nationwide practical joke. And really, that just seems too unwieldy to actually carry off. So we're going with the denial theory of the crimes against fashion, decency, and/or humanity.
That was Fat is the New 30 by Jill Connor Brown. In 1978, Kim Howard Johnson ran away to join the circus, Monty Python's Flying Circus. The Pythons converged on Tunisia to film their classic Life of Brian, and Howard found himself in the thick of it. He became the unit journalist, substitute still photographer, Roman soldier, peasant, near stalker, and ultimately friend and confidant of the comedy legends. He also kept a detailed journal of what he saw and heard on set and off throughout those 6 weeks. The result, Monty Python's Tunisian Holiday, My Life with Brian, is a unique eyewitness account that reveals the Pythons at work and play. Diehard fans will get a fresh take on the comedy greats through some never-before-revealed nuggets of Python brilliance. What John Cleese offered in exchange for suntan lotion. Terry Jones directing in drag. Michael Palin's secret to playing revolutionaries and peasants. Graham Chapman getting naked and oh so much more. Johnny Heller and Simon Vance narrate the tale of a brilliant period of comedy history and the Pythons in their prime.
Forward by Michael Palin. If anyone can remember more about making Life of Brian than me, it's Kim Howard Johnson. He came, he saw, he got into costume. While the rest of us were fighting to upstage each other, Howard had a notebook hidden in his toga. And he was that rare thing, a Python fan who could spell. He didn't miss a trick. Not for him the long lunches after a stoning, or the card schools after crucifixion. Kim Howard Johnson saw it all happen, and his diary fills those gaps that none of the rest of us can remember. Or maybe daren't remember. An essential tool for Python nuts. An apology for not reading this book before writing the foreword. John Cleese. Of all the books I am planning to read in my dotage, there is none I am more looking forward to than Monty Python's Tunisian Holiday. This is truly one of the finest volumes I've seen in years. Beautiful binding, all the pages held securely in place in the proper order, a real feast for the eyes, and a magnificent product of the bookbinder's art. Let your eyes lovingly gaze over each and every letter of the alphabet, assembled in neatly ordered rows in the traditional manner. Yes, this one surely looks like a winner. And did I mention the fabulous photographs, both in black and white and colour? The entire package is bathed in the aroma of the finest India ink. Flip through the pages and listen to the paper rustle. Run your fingers leisurely over each and every page. Taste the glossy goodness of the dust jacket. Yes, this volume is truly a feast for all the senses. Of all the books I'd love to read as soon as I get a spare moment, Monty Python's Tunisian Holiday is undoubtedly in the top 1,000. But then, why wouldn't it be? Not only does Howard Johnson know more about Python than anyone outside of the IRS, he was in Tunisia for most of the filming of Life of Brian, and is the only person who captured every thoughtless remark, heated exchange, embarrassing detail, petty insult, and spiteful act of indifference. So forgive me for not starting this book before writing the foreword. But I've got a chiropractor's appointment in 20 minutes. I leave you in the highly capable hands of Howard, who I know will take very good care of you. Foreword by Eric Idle. A word about the author. Kim Howard Johnson was invented by Graham Chapman during an idle moment on the set of Life of Brian. "Let's invent a person," he said. "An American," said Cleese. "An American fan from the Midwest," chimed in Palin, "who keeps a daily diary of Python filming, and then doesn't publish it for years and years." "Who would believe that?" I remember muttering disgruntedly. "Oh, you'd be surprised," said Terry Gilliam, helping himself to some more of my per diem. "Americans can be very naive. They'll buy almost anything." Terry Jones was away checking out asses. And it was only later, over dinner, after he had cast a slim young donkey, that we told him we had made up a character called Kim Howard Johnson. In fact, it was he who added the quote marks. How we laughed! And each day we'd make up stuff this person would write about us. Indeed, so well was Howard written that he went on to have quite a successful career in America. And at one time he even worked for John Cleese as a tax dodge. So ridiculous has the internet become that nowadays people take this character seriously, not only believing he is real, but actually suggesting he worked with the late Del Close, a character clearly made up by Robin Williams during an improv night in Chicago. But you and I know better about American sources and reminiscences and Fox Newses and will not easily be taken in by such an evident hoax. As your American president might have said, if he could ever string enough words together, just because something isn't true is no reason not to believe in it.
We've just heard Monty Python's Tunisian Holiday by Kim Howard Johnson.
Readers, you just never know what will tickle your funny bone. But I hope we've shared a chuckle or two during the show. There are so many titles out there to entertain you. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for lots of suggestions. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week at the Book Report.